This gentleman is a television columnist. He writes for TV Week, and he's also got his blog, TV Howl. And I can tell this guy is going to fit in perfectly with us because the tagline on TV Howl says the best TV columnist in America. And I just I appreciate anybody that could put that up there about themselves on there. I can tell we're going to get along great, Adam. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Well, it's really nice of you to have me on and to mention that tagline that I put on my blog at a moment of really irrational hubris, you know. But I thought, you know, in the new internet world, this is what you do. You package yourself. You know what I mean? And for all I know, three people read that thing. But, you know, I insist that I am the best TV columnist in America. And you should... You should know, if you don't, that I spent 20 years at the New York Post covering television.
I do indeed.
And so some of your listeners may know me from that. So it's great to be on.
I think
so. And to follow George the Animal Steel.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really amazing.
Yeah, how do you follow that act, huh?
Well, I don't know, a full Nelson? Dropkick or whatever they call those.
He used to use some version. It wasn't a full Nelson. I think he had some kind of hammer lock back in his heel days. But
yes.
Yeah,
it's remember the Soprano drop? That was one of the great moves.
That's just absolutely an awesome one right there. But it's great to have you on. As you mentioned, a lot of stuff that you did at the New York Post. You're doing some great things now here.
Thank
with
you.
With TV Week, with the new media angle on it, with TV Howl, and again. You've been on top of some of the biggest stories that we've seen, really, in the business here. But again, what we've seen over the course of the last 2 weeks, I mean, to me, it's the biggest story of 2009 in terms of pop culture. I'd argue even bigger than the inauguration of this president. When you look at this to me is just one of these things. We get these only very sporadically, I think, in American life. John Lennon, Princess Di, I'm trying to think of, you know, anybody else in there, but this just doesn't come around every day.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Those two unfortunate deaths that you just mentioned were certainly, you know, surprise deaths, you know, John Lennon being murdered and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And however, just reading something online about the viewership for the Michael Jackson memorial, and did you know that the Ronald Reagan funeral in, I think it was it 2004, 2003, actually had more viewers than Princess Di's funeral and more than the Michael Jackson memorial?
Really?
It's fascinating, yeah. Now, I guess in 2004, he had 35 million viewers. And it's estimated today that the Jackson Memorial Service on maybe a dozen networks had 31 million. You know, it's a little bit like splitting hairs, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But someone made a good point in the story that, and they can't count this yet, if at all, that a lot of people watched the Jackson Memorial via the new media of either handheld devices or the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And for all we know, that added more millions than we can calculate. So it's interesting what you said about, you know, the as far as the year in pop culture and equating this last 2 weeks with, you know, the inauguration of President Obama. That's very interesting. You're the first person I've heard to talk about those two in the same sentence. Which ranks higher? I'll tell you what ranks as the biggest surprise. Is this Michael Jackson thing? Are you surprised, as I am, at the outpouring?
I am a little bit, but you know, part of it, I think part of it's tied up, and this is where, and I've decried on this show, you know, the backlash, you know, that we're seeing in some quarters and everything like that, because again, I think what a lot of people are mourning, in a sense, Adam, we're mourning part of our own lives here. We've all got memories and stuff. I mean, I'm the quintessential example of that. I was a kid when Thriller came out. I mean, I grew up in that period of time. I mean, we've all got memories of our lives tied up with that. And there's something that, especially for the freak show that the guy's life degenerated into, there's something that people feel... Not glad that he's gone, but at least glad that the good memories of him are liberated from that somehow. You know, I don't know how much of this is mourning for him per se, and about maybe something else. I don't know how you see it.
This is so interesting on so many levels, and I'll try not to go off on 10 different tangents. But the reason I asked about whether you were surprised, I suppose, is 'cause I was. I mean, you know, I guess maybe it's because I was in the tabloid media for a long time, and sometimes you tend to focus, as you were talking about just a moment ago, on sort of the tabloid issues, the freak show issues. I mean, pardon me for saying this, but until he died and the entire world wept, I thought he was considered by most to be an unfortunate and tragic, frankly, a has-been.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean, I know he was planning these shows and everything, and the fanatics who will always love him, I suppose, bought all the tickets. But that's not like a billion people worldwide. That's however many thousands were able to get tickets. So it's been very interesting to see the nostalgia. You say you're the generation of Thriller. I go back farther than that to the Jackson 5.
Mm-hmm.
And you do feel like you grew up with people.
Yeah.
And there's been a great PR push on the part of the Jackson camp. And I don't say that cynically. But in this week and a half of coverage, if you've watched basically the cable news every evening, cable news channels, you've seen a kind of full-court press out there of storytelling by people who knew him, sort of illuminating the real man behind the wax face. You know what I mean?
Right.
And he seems to be not such a bad guy. And I'm starting to come around to think that he wasn't really a freak. He was kind of a soft-spoken guy. He was kind of different, maybe almost like an alien from another planet, but he was not harmful.
Yeah.
And I think the only people that can testify to the harm he did is anyone, frankly, he may have allegedly behaved improperly with. And you know what I'm alluding to.
Yes.
I don't want to draw pictures here on your show, but, you know, maybe he wreaked some real havoc in some kids' lives. Or maybe not. You know, in that trial they held, there was reasonable doubt enough to acquit him. And I'm beginning to have the same reasonable doubts as they may have had in that courtroom.
That's the strange thing. I'm kind of coming around to that, too. Do you get the sense, though, on this? Because there are, you know, we've seen both sides of this come to, you know, more to light in recent days. The whole thing, you know, potential evidence that he may have been set up versus potential evidence that, hey, look, the kid knew what his genitalia looked like, swore to it, whatever. It matched the photographs, you
yeah.
know. So that, I mean, do you get the sense that you and I might be thinking he might not have done it because that's what we want to believe right now?
There's some of that. That's another aspect of the great complication that this has sort of caused in our brains. Because if you read the details that we're forgetting, I suppose, like you just mentioned, the identification of private physical characteristics, then, yes, it does seem like if you refer to the cut-and-dried court papers, which I suppose you could find on smokinggun.com or if you go on the Vanity Fair magazine website, you know, they've reposted all their coverage that they did, those in-depth stories by Maureen Orth over the years.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back and look at them, perhaps your doubts about that you're feeling now about his behavior may in fact be quelled in the belief that he did do these things. In a way, again, because I was not one who was molested, and therefore I have no emotional baggage about him,
mm-hmm.
it's almost like death to me, who was not involved in those things, liberates him from those tragic and upsetting stories. And what is durable is the art that he left. And in the end, art is really the only thing that does last.
That's...
You know, it really is. I don't know if they'll be listening to Michael Jackson in 1,000 years, but and that's a whole other issue. You know, has he gotten... Is the praise being offered to him, or the praise about him, is it in fact too high at times?
It could be.
Yeah.
Even on the artistic level, where the man was a genius, there could be some hyperbole out there. I want to ask you about this, too, because I'm fascinated by the everything about this, the dichotomy, the mixed emotions, the everything that we just don't know what to make of this.
I've been very sad about it.
Yeah.
For no reason. I didn't know the man.
Oh, you know, but you know what?
You know.
But again, you don't have to justify that. He's got three kids he left behind. He's got a family that, you know, might have been dysfunctional in some ways. But you know what I mean? There's human reasons.
Yeah, that's true. And I think they loved him.
Yeah.
You know, he was their unusual brother.
Yeah.
And you love him anyway, you know.
Part of how the prism of this has changed is I would have cynically said before this happened, their meal ticket. I wouldn't say that anymore. I think that we've seen that they did love him and didn't look at him necessarily that way, and that, you know, maybe they weren't all hangers-on, but, you know, and I think, the matter of fact, the real hangers-on, I think, are the ones that were not related to him, that were on the inside. But, you know, as we look at this, I'm fascinated by all the different angles of this that maybe we'll never be able to fully reconcile. Here's one of them. I was talking to a friend the night of the Michael Jackson death coverage when it first hit, and he agreed with me, and I said, on one level, this is just an insanely shocking. Mm-hmm. On another level, could this have ended any other way? We didn't think we'd see, you know, on a subconscious level even, you didn't think this guy was going to go 80 years old quietly in the middle of the night. Everything in the last two decades had been such a tabloid freak show.
True.
This is the only coda that there really could have been. We're shocked that it happened. By the same token, we can't be shocked because it's the logical culmination of everything in the man's life.
Well, or does it only seem logical in hindsight that he would die in the larger-than-life manner of Elvis Presley or Marilyn Monroe or James Dean? You know what I mean? Because had he not died, Rick, he'd be alive. And for all we knew, he might have lived to be a crazy 80-year-old.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? It's very interesting about these health issues with him. I guess we may or may not learn about what they were, whether he was so skeletal that he could do nothing more than drop dead, or he was in fact in the peak of physical health and ready to do 50 shows.
Yeah, I mean, and we've heard wildly different accounts of that, and the truth is going to come out, I think, as it always does. But what I'm wondering also here, you know, we talked a little bit about the notion of, and again, you've written some excellent stories on this, whether it be the one of now, maybe now he can rest in peace, or the other one about the that now he belongs to the ages. Your coverage of the ceremony itself yesterday,
which I thought was a beautiful thing. It really was.
It was, and you know what, and. You know, you could have been cynical about things maybe to an extent going in, but, you know, the notion of his daughter getting up there at the end and saying what she said and everything like that. I mean, if you don't sit there, you know, and feel a little choked up about that, you're just not human.
Well, when we write those things, you sometimes focus right on the visceral instant reaction.
Yeah.
And I felt that was the right way. Now, I've thought about it a lot, and there are reasons to be cynical. I mean, get ready for them to package the memorial service itself on a DVD.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
I mean, of course they will. And then, I mean, these things, you've probably done the same thought process. You think about one angle on this Michael Jackson story, then you cancel it out with something else in your head. Like, you could say it's crass the way they're going to market his death, and they're going to turn Neverland into a Graceland, you know, and they're going to have exhibits there, and people are going to go by the busload. But then you think, and then, okay, that might seem crass, but then you think, why don't they have the right to do that? You know, this is America. You know, it's only crass if they make it crass. It doesn't have to be tasteless. I mean, Graceland itself isn't that tasteless. I've been to Graceland.
Yeah. Oh,
you know, it's a very interesting tour that you take there.
I'm sure.
And he was a very important guy, Elvis, you know.
Oh, sure, yeah. I see that. But having said that, you talk about Elvis, boy, it didn't take Joe Jackson long to play the Colonel Tom Parker card, did it? He'll be bigger dead than he was alive.
Well,
you know, as bad as that was.
And then you come down to some of the personalities involved, and you think, you know, is Joe just 80 years old and addle-brained or something?
Yeah.
Or was he always kind of this cruel, single-minded business guy who trained his children like they were in an animal act, and, you know, beating them if they didn't jump through the flaming hoop the right way, you know? And you get that impression from some of Michael's interviews that have been aired in the past week.
Yeah.
You know, the ones with Oprah, the ones with Martin Bashir. You know, Joe is one of the more pathetic figures that we've seen. Now, luckily, he kind of disappeared after the second or third day from the public view. Did you notice that? After the BET Awards, someone told him to stay home.
Yeah, so much the better. You know, too bad it wasn't sooner in the process. But, yeah, the less we ever see of that old guy, the better off everybody's going to be. But I'm wondering about this. You know, we've talked about where this sits in the pop culture landscape for this year. My gut feeling, as I told you, that in a sense this is even bigger this year than Obama's inauguration. And looking ahead here, and summertime always seems to be the time of year for shaping, you know, the big pop culture stories of the year. Yes. And I'm thinking to myself, short of Kim Jong-il having one of those Typhoon, you know, two missiles that can hit Hawaii, short of a world catastrophe like that, I don't think we're going to see anything bigger than this. I think we've seen the story of the year.
One never knows, I suppose, and I hope we don't have one of those tragic events.
Oh, definitely not.
But the 2 weeks of this, the timing, it was really interesting. And just, I guess my perspective, Rick, is often from the perspective of television, because I've been steeped in it for so long. And this is one of those times of year when there's not a lot else on television. And because it's summer, there's just something about summers, and I know this from being in the news business, where people go on vacations, life is a little more leisurely. We had the July 4th weekend, which began for many people around Thursday, July 2nd, where this was a great 2 weeks to devote wall-to-wall coverage to a thing, because it wasn't like there was a lot else going on. I'm not sure what they would have substituted it with. I mean, would the terrible murder of this quarterback been a bigger story? You know, I don't, you know, if it had not been for the Michael Jackson logjam, I mean, I don't really know.
Well,
and recall that he followed a handful of other celebrity deaths.
Yeah.
Which was one of the odd things about this.
Well, you wrote about Billy Mays, too. I mean, that was one that was shocking. We were just getting ones in close proximity. It's almost like Ed McMahon, yeah, you know, as with anybody else, it's always jarring when it happens. But we knew he was in declining health. Everybody knew Farrah was pretty much near the end. It was just a question of when. Then there's Michael. Then it starts to get a little bit, you know, actually much bigger. And then Billy Mays, we didn't feel it as jarring because he wasn't as part of the cultural landscape. It was more recent than MJ. But in many ways, that was more surprising.
Well, and it just sort of accumulated.
Yeah.
Because I can tell you from being in the news business that the confluence of celebrity deaths, you know, people joke morbidly, you know, how these things comes in threes or pairs or whatever. But to tell you the truth, they don't really.
Right.
Especially in terms of celebrities being like on par with each other. Like, I know that newspapers had to struggle with how to handle Farrah and Michael because they were virtually the same time. And that doesn't happen that much. And celebrity deaths, editors in the news media differ on them. Some of them then tend to downplay them too much. Others tend to say, look, this is what everyone will be talking about. Put it on page one. And there's usually a debate about it. I always lean toward the sentiment of page one. And this is because many years ago, I read something about People magazine, which is, if nothing else, one of the smartest edited magazines that we have. You know, whether you like its celebrity journalism or not, it's a very good magazine in terms of the way it's made. I remember reading that their death covers are their best-selling magazines. You know, the ones where they say, you know, a touching tribute to so-and-so. America says goodbye to so-and-so. You know, so there's something about, there's something on one level of a celebrity death and one this big as being, you know, a no-brainer. And this is why Anderson Cooper and Larry King have hammered this story every night.
You know,
and they were right about it too. They're the ones that own this story, to tell you the truth.
Oh, they are. They are, and they're you know, oftentimes good arbiters of what's really, you know, gaining traction with the American people. That's one of these things, Adam. You know, it's universal, and I'll even tie it back to the subject matter of our previous guest, George the Animal Steele, pro wrestler. Let me tell you something. the insider newsletter, Wrestling Observer, that Dave Meltzer puts out, what are some of the most requested back issues of all time when he's written obituaries for these guys when they've passed away? People want to read the Bruiser Brody tribute. People want to read this, that, and it's not a morbid thing. It's not that Meltzer pushes it that way. It's just, it is what it is. These are the things we gravitate towards, so I can absolutely believe what you're saying about the whole People magazine
cover. In the final analysis, we're a sentimental people.
Yeah.
And, you know, you grow up with entertainers.